Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. I'm Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by Gail Schimmel.
Hello Fiona.
Hi Gail, are you ready to tell us about your writing week?
It's been more of the same. I'm not going to give you any startling new insights this week because I'm in that read over and edit phase with my rom-com. Mm-hmm. And our loyal listeners will know that my superpower is laziness. And this is where laziness really is a superpower. I write a very clean first draft. So I don't have to do that thing other writers do where you have to go back and fix and rework and like write. I don't write a second draft. That is not a thing I've ever had to do, except the time my laptop was stolen with 25,000 words of a novel. But other than that, I've never written a second draft. So it's editing, it's cleaning up, it's seeing how the experience is as a reader. And one of the things I find interesting is I have to do it quite quickly because I have to have the experience of a reader of remembering, because we all know I have a terrible memory, of remembering the story and picking up the inconsistencies and that kind of thing. So I'm feeling very compelled by this project that mm-hmm. I have to do it quickly. I have to have the experience the reader would have. When is the pacing dropping? Noticing when I lose interest in what I'm reading. Is it a pacing problem? Noticing the mistakes I've made in character development, in story arc and that kind of thing. And then fixing up the often very confusing sentence I've written, thinking it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. We know I'm not one of those people who tries to write beautiful sentences, but really sometimes I fail so spectacularly at writing a beautiful sentence that it needs a little bit of help. So that's where I've been this week, and I'm having quite fun. What about you, Fiona?
I have come to understand something about myself that I didn't know before, because I wasn't in this situation. When I still had three kids at home of school age, I didn't have days where I had the whole day to write. I had an hour here, half an hour there, 20 minutes sitting in the orthodontist's waiting room, etc. And I found it easier to be productive then. And now there are times where I've created, for example, an afternoon for myself. An afternoon to write. Mm-hmm. I can write until I need to start dinner. Mm-hmm. And I find myself messing around for 2 or 3 hours. And when that deadline is approaching where I really do have to start dinner or nobody's going to eat tonight, I suddenly kick into gear and my focus comes online and I start writing like a maniac, sort of chasing that deadline. And I never knew that about myself, that I need the urgency of time pressure to activate my creative brain. That having too much time and a sort of whole unstructured morning or a whole unstructured afternoon is not good for me. Mm. And I find now if I'm not happy with what I did in the afternoon, I'm working frantically in the evenings before going to bed because I have to sort of catch up. And I'm chasing this deadline of, oh, I wanted to be in bed by 11 sort of thing. It's very weird. As I'm saying, it doesn't sound particularly healthy, but it's something I just didn't know about myself.
And it's so interesting to me because it's something I suspect about myself. So I have the fantasy of being a full-time writer, but I suspect that I would do exactly that, that I would faff, that I would stare, that I would wander off in my head somewhere else, that I would doom scroll till the end mm-hmm. of time, mm-hmm. and that I actually only am able to write because I'm pressured about time and I have to fit it in. So I'm interested to watch this grow and see if you find a way to resolve it.
I think I'm going to have to set sort of artificial deadlines for myself somehow. Maybe go back to the Pomodoro method or something to create that urgency that seems to be the thing I need in order to spur me on.
Fill up your day with something not writing. Do some volunteer work, that kind of create a pressurized life in order that you can be pressurized and stressed. And no, that's just not a good idea. Yeah.
Who wants to live a long life anyway?
And Fiona, between faffing around and staring at your computer and then writing furiously, are you managing to read, watch, do anything like that?
Yes, yes. I've been reading Stoneyard Devotional by Charlotte Wood, which was on the long lists and short lists, I think at the end of 2024. It's been in the ether for a while, and I saw something that reminded me that I'd never read it. So I thought, okay, it's a short book. I'm going to go back and catch up on that one. And I see why it was so well received. There are parts of it that are really very good, but it suffers from something that I recognize in myself, which is an urge to share my important thoughts with the world. So she's created a narrative structure which is pretty loose. A woman leaves her husband, checks out of her life, and basically joins a nunnery in the middle of Australia. And she doesn't intend to join it, but she goes there for a short while as a kind of retreat, and then she keeps going back until eventually she stays. She just never leaves. She doesn't become a nun. She just becomes like a lay person who lives there and contributes to the sisterhood. And that's it. So not a very plot-driven story. And there are things that happen, and there are reflections on childhood bullying and various things that are very compelling and very interesting. But you can see that she saw this as an opportunity to share her thoughts. Mm. She has thoughts about the Australian bush. She has thoughts about climate change. She has thoughts about biodiversity and habitat. And she's using this as a way to kind of share her essays with the world. And it's something that I sometimes do. I think, oh yes, I have had thoughts with a capital T on this issue that I must share, and therefore will kind of force it into my plot. Have you read books like this?
I have, and I also understand the temptation to write, and you're making me think a lot because I've got a, what might be my next thing I write bubbling. I'm not really sure. And I do find myself that I keep thinking when I'll have another thing, I think, oh, you can put it into that book. That can be one of her things.
Mm-hmm,
and mm-hmm. while some of it might lead very nicely into plot things, you're making me think I must be important not to give this character all my thoughts with a capital T.
What about you, Gail? What have you been reading or watching?
So I want to talk about a book. I read it a little while ago, but and I don't know how to say it, so this is going to be an awkward conversation. I don't know how to say the name of the book or the author.
Oh, dear.
So it's Katabasis,
yes,
by R.F. Kuang, I believe is how we say her surname.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it. It is about a journey into hell. To save this woman believes she has killed her lecturer and she needs to go and save him. She hates him, but she needs him to finish her degree. So she sets to hell, as one does, to rescue her lecturer. And I was a bit wary of it because I don't like very Dante-like hell escapes. Mm-hmm. I don't like monsters. And so the book that I'm thinking of is Leigh Bardugo, Ninth House, which I loved the book, but then there was a hell scene that I found just too, like a bad acid trip, and not, I think my brain is just, I can go so far in fantasy and then it becomes too much for me. Mm-hmm. So I was worried this book would be like that, and it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually quite charming and quirky, and there's a love story, and it's a lovely book. I enjoyed it very much. But what I'm interested in is how R.F. Kuang writes completely different books.
Yes.
There's Yellowface, there's Babel, there's Katabasis, there's, she doesn't seem to feel any need to stick to a genre.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got two other examples, and I know I'm forgetting a third one, of young writers who are like this. The one is Olivia Blake,
mm-hmm.
who is probably best known for the Atlas 6 trilogy. I think it's a trilogy. But she also writes quite rom-commy, lighty. I've just read Girl Dinner, which I will say I did not enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
I found it was a weak book for me. Other people might love it, but I like the premise. I didn't like the execution. But again, feels no need to stick to a genre. And then locally, we have Shamiz Patel,
mm-hmm.
who has written mm-hmm. beautiful, beautiful fantasy books and is now writing beautiful, beautiful rom-com books.
Yes.
Her latest is magnificent. But doesn't seem to feel any problem with this. Whereas I feel a huge pressure. You have to decide what kind of writer you're going to be, and then you must stick to it. And I am a domestic noir writer, and I mustn't go off writing a rom-com. Failed at that one. But maybe I'm failing at writing the rom-com. Don't know. And I'm interested in the way these younger writers, international writers, don't feel this problem.
I think it's a good development. I think it's good for someone's career and for literature in general if writers can feel free to explore genres.
Completely, completely. As a writer, I think it's magnificent. As a reader, now you don't know that your R.F. Kuang is the kind of book that you like. You're going to have to read it to discover it, and it might be one. In fact, another one who does it is Lionel Shriver.
Right.
Because she writes books I love, and then books that are very economic-y that I cannot bear. Like her books that I hate, and her books that I love, I love. And I have to start reading them to know which one it's going to be. So, like, is it a bit cheaty of the writer? Should there be a warning? This is, I suppose, like the way Shamiz does it, you look at the cover and you know what you're getting. But it's interesting.
It is interesting. And another writer who has written two very different books in different genres, apart from them both being literary, is our guest today. Our guest today is David Cornwell. David is the author of Like It Matters, which was published by Penguin Random House in 2016, and also most recently the critically acclaimed Hell of a Country, published in 2025 by Quella Books. David is a novelist, a screenwriter, and a musician, and we are very pleased to have him in the studio with us today. Hi, David, and welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Fiona. Thank you, Gail, for having me. Great to be here.
David, we're going to start where we always start. Tell us about your writing week.
Yes, okay, a bit of an interesting writing week. I've been waiting for a while for some feedback to maybe kind of give me a bit of direction on where I should be focusing my energies. That feedback duly came this week, and although it was a bit disappointing, it was at least clarifying. So I have spent the last few days kind of trying to resolder a connection to a project that's about halfway through, and I'm really excited to get back to it. Hopefully click back into my usual routine next week on it.
And is that a novel project?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
And what does that usual routine look like?
I wake up very early in the morning. I always have. And it always used to be wake up early and write immediately, well, coffee and write immediately first thing. But as I've got older, I've found the need to do kind of some walking and yoga in the morning more and more pressing, just to kind of get my back through the week to week. I mean, it's so depressing. I can't believe I'm even saying this, but hey, it's the truth. So now it's a wake up still very early, kind of walk, do some yoga, and then write. So I'm only able to fit in maybe an hour and a half every day, but ideally it is daily, you know, regular, and just a little bit forward every day, hopefully. Yeah.
And in that hour and a half, what are you hoping to achieve? Is it a word count? Is it a part of the book? What's a good day for you? What's a bad day?
Oh, it's such a good question. You know, sometimes I will spend an hour and a half taking out a few words and feel great about things. So I'm not very strict about forward momentum, which I probably should be stricter. I'd say maybe 300 words, 350. I'm totally happy with that for a day. If there's dialogue, it could go up to about 700. Never really more than that, I must admit. I tend to make very slow progress. My sort of rule is that advice from Hemingway, which is basically just stop every day, you know, when you're going well and where you know you're going to go back to. And then while I'm doing my day job and going about my other business, I will kind of keep a notebook where I kind of, you know, write about what's coming next, as much as possible, just to kind of keep me connected between times where I'm actually writing. Yeah.
And I'm interested in that dialogue gives you more words, because I find I love writing dialogue, but it gives me less words. What do you think it is? Do you just get into it? What is it about dialogue that you write so many more words?
It's a great question. So maybe it's when dialogue is going well, because I think what I can do sometimes is really just kind of hear the two voices sort of, you know, going back and forth. And then so I can get that down on the page quicker. And then, of course, it's refining it, and I'll probably lose, you know, most of what's gone down. But it helps me. I guess it's other people are in charge of what's being said, even though they are fictional other people, might just push me along a little bit quicker for that.
You're taking dictation, basically.
I liked it. Honestly, when the writing is going very well, it does feel like that. That's an excellent way of putting it. Absolutely.
And can you take us back to your early origin story? Hmm. Growing up, did you always want to be a writer? Was it something that was always in your mind and in your life? How did that come about? And then how did that first novel kind of come into being?
Hmm. So my dad was an English professor and my mom was a librarian. So, I mean, books were such an integral part of sort of growing up for me. It was just surrounded by books all the time. And yes, I kind of always did want to be a writer. It's been the most kind of disenchanting, disabusing thing of my life, realizing that, oh, I've got to do something else as well as this. Oh, okay. I guess. So yes, no, I always wanted to be a writer. I kind of started, I guess, semi-seriously, and maybe in high school, I took myself very seriously, at least in high school, kind of wrote through university. I did an MA in creative writing at UCT, which I was so grateful that Damon Gulgut ended up being my supervisor. And so I always speak so highly of that program. Just that relationship remains in my life now as really one of my most treasured friendships. So yeah, kind of did all the almost sort of quite traditional sort of writing path, I suppose. You know, studied English Lit, of course, etc. And yeah, always wanted to do this, and was kind of, you know, delighted. So I wrote a collection of short stories for my masters, which against everyone's advice, because it's very difficult to publish short stories, at least first step. And then chose the short story that I thought had the most kind of like dramatic potential, and took the key scene from that, and then sort of kind of built a novel around that, and a voice that I had sort of discovered while writing the stories. And then, yeah, just was so delighted that that ended up being, yeah, being published on the first try, which is, yeah, very lucky. I totally understand that now.
I'm very interested in that, taking a part of a short story and turning it into a novel, because often when an idea comes, it's a short story idea or it's a novel idea. I don't know if this is an impossible question to answer, but how did you go about that? How did you build a short story idea into a novel idea?
Yeah. So what I think was that I really enjoyed, so the basic kind of like this, like the main scene of action were these two people on a deserted road late at night on their way to a deal that goes bad. And I think what I like that basic narrative situation. But I actually think that the story, the people who were involved there maybe weren't perfectly suited to the situation. And then it's quite interesting. It's almost like a jigsaw. I had this other set of characters that I thought would actually really fit that, you know, that kind of fate, or, you know, it's the kind of thing that should actually exactly happen to them. So it was kind of a bit of a mix and match of sort of leading with this voice. You know, the first book is a first person narrative, and it is, for me, like the kind of what's going on technically or whatever, or the craft aspect, is it's very much like a study in voice or whatever. So I kind of led with that. And then I at least had this, it's so difficult to understand the pacing of how much action belongs in a novel first time around. And it was so great then to at least have this big main scene that I knew I was writing towards and then had to write out of. And that was very helpful, basically, just to kind of keep me on track while I was able to finish it. And then, of course, the editing started, because I had thrown a whole bunch of other events in that didn't really need to be there either. So, yeah.
Can you talk us through the editing process for you? Are you a big self-editor who sort of hones and hones and hones before you're ready to show it to anyone? And then how do you react to sort of having another editor, another set of eyes step in and give you input that you then need to change your manuscript according to?
Yeah, I think I've got better at being too I do self-edit a lot, and often as I'm going along, which is kind of not always. Sometimes I find it very important, because if the voice isn't right, I don't feel like I can go forward. And so sometimes I do need a self-edit as I go along. But I think I've got better at just understanding that there are going to be so many opportunities to go back to this thing. It's going to sit in, sort of in suspension for sort of so many periods. You know, there will be chances to go back to it, as being a very good thing for me just to kind of remember. And so not be too precious as I go along. In terms of working with other people, I mean, mostly I've loved it. I mean, mostly I really, really, I find it so amazing how people can spot things in a story that even though you've read it 100 times, it just never occurred to you to think about that. I think Raymond Carver said, anyone should be able to give you good advice on your story. Like, you should just take any reader's advice, very seriously, because, you're not in control of how it's read ultimately, even though you want to be. I've mostly loved it, I must say. Bar a couple of very, sort of final bad reader's reports I've got along the way, but those have been so bad that it's been like, okay, well, there's no, let's try somebody else almost. I've never had like a difficult editorial relationship. It's either been no relationship at all or kind of very easy.
I want to go back a bit. Sorry, I'm still stuck in process. I could spend the whole hour in process. You talked about you had that idea, those two guys going to a deal that's going to go wrong and bringing the characters. To what extent do you plot that out more? To what extent are you a plotter? To what extent are you a pantser? Writing by the seat of your pants.
I wish I could remember who described it like this, but because I've kept it close in memory, but they've described it as kind of like driving on a dark road. Yes, exactly, with 100%. So I find that. So I have a general sense of where I want to end up, of like the direction of travel, hopefully. But the only thing that's really lit up is kind of, really what I'm working on right now. And I stay very open to the characters doing surprising things and taking turns that I wasn't necessarily planning for. And then what I'll do is I kind of, when I'm sort of in the midst of a scene, like I said, I'll spend the time that I'm not able to be, on the project, sort of just making notes to myself about like maybe what should happen, maybe what could happen. So I think it's a bit of both, but it's kind of micro planning. It's kind of like looking at, maybe I kind of plan out beats of something that I'm busy on right now. And then also, like I said, in the actual process, I'm more than happy to be taken on a direction I wasn't expecting to go.
David, there's quite an established literary genre of drug memoirs. I'm thinking of Bukowski and Burroughs and others, and also films in that genre. And your book, Like It Matters, is a novel. But were you influenced, were you sort of consciously contributing to the genre? Were you influenced by what others had been doing? Or were you sort of writing completely de novo, as it were?
No, I would say of that list, which is an excellent list, I'd add Dennis Johnson as my primary. I mean, he's my literary hero by a long shot. And so novels like Jesus' Son or Angels were really sort of influential. I think, that book more came out of, I feel like there's something about that voice that I thought was compelling, and that was kind of, it's not the easiest kind of voice to write, where someone is somewhat conscious of the things that are sort of, dragging them down, but they're not quite able to take that final step and sort of, free themselves, in this case, kind of, sort of an addiction. And then also a toxic relationship that obviously sort of feeds into the addiction. So it was more... it was more an act of emulation, I suppose, really where that came from. And so that voice then, I find like, with all projects, like sort of once it starts rolling downhill, things just attach, so effortlessly. So, the voice brought the relationship, brought the, matched with that central event. And then the themes kind of, kind of get bound up in this ball as it starts rolling. So, it's what started as an act of kind of emulation, I would say, then became really a study on character and voice, would be the way I understand that first book.
When you told us about your early years, you said when you discovered you couldn't be a writer the whole time, that was a bit disappointing. But everything I've read about you, your real jobs are still quite creative jobs, or do you have a secret, very sensible real job that you're not telling us about?
So right now I do learning design, instructional design, kind of like so creating kind of learning materials mostly for online use. Before that, I'd always either taught or written journalism. So this is a kind of combination of the two, and it certainly does require sort of creative energies. But no, it is it's very sensible. I hate to disappoint, but it's a very sensible sort of 10-hour-a-day job. But luckily, I get to do it from home, which saves enough time to fit in some writing and revising and all the other necessary tasks.
And very interesting, I think, very time, that online learning is quite an exciting space at the moment.
Yeah. Ever since COVID, there's been a lot of jobs available, especially for people who have kind of humanities degrees that are a little bit, your anthropology, philosophy. I did philosophy as my other subject at university, kind of majors, where it's just a little bit like, okay, I need to apply this somehow. It's a great space, because it's, it's critical thinking. It's, sort of synthesizing research. It's clear communication. It's a lot of sort of very humanity friendly skills that are actually being able to be put into a kind of a productive sort of viable job, which is I'm very grateful for sure.
David, when you are writing about a social hot button issue like addiction, do you feel a weight of responsibility on your shoulders, or do you feel free to write about it however you like? In other words, not glamorize it, sort of turn it into a cautionary tale, stay on message about this, or did you feel a great deal of creative freedom in writing this book?
Yeah, great question. I think first and foremost, it's about the character, and they need to have a credible, psychological experience. And then those considerations, though, obviously are very important. You really don't want to... it's worse than causing offense. It's, it's being, it's to commit it like a kind of a gross, it's insensitivity. It's to be very callous if you kind of don't think about these things and how they might come across. I hope, there's always obviously a bit of risk though, because, you never know quite how people are going to take, the words that you've put down. You've thought, very clearly that they must sort of encode a certain meaning or put across a certain message. But of course, you've got to just like, kind of let that go once they're on the page. It's up to someone else to interpret them. So there is, I wouldn't call it fear, but I mean, there is just a sense of really wanting to do it right, not to, not to kind of transgress, because it is, for me, it is a moral issue. It really is kind of, how one chooses to represent these things that are, easy and safe to sometimes read about in fiction, but obviously, much, harder and can really sort of dominate people's lives. So, it's difficult, but, it's something that I'm aware of throughout the whole process, in every line and in every edit and the rest of it.
And those negative readers' reports that you might ever have got, were they around that issue? Just people who reacted incredibly negatively to anything about drugs?
Yeah. Essentially, I mean, for me, I've got to the point where I can put it in a box as like kind of, it's just a very conservative reader who got freaked out by some of the scenes and situations, I would say so. Like you said, that kind of tradition of that sort of drug memoir or sort of, a character who, where the sort of arc of the novel is someone trying to pull themselves out of addiction is something that is very common in US literature, British literature as well, maybe to a slightly lesser extent, but not so, they're not a lot of, especially when I wrote, wrote this one back in 2016, I think they've actually been more subsequently. There just weren't a lot of sort of literary forebears in the South African context, which I think also contributed to that kind of response. It's just kind of a bit like, what is this? Where do I put it? It's fine.
Books are like people. Not everyone likes every book. Yes. Not everyone likes every person. I want to talk about screenwriting. I want you to tell us how it's different, how it's the same. I want you to tell us everything about screenwriting. Just start talking about screenwriting.
I wish I was more of an authority in that. I wish I had more sort of experience under the belt. But I do love talking about this topic because they are so different, you know. And I think they are more different than I wish I had realized how different they were, you know, kind of in the previous sort of projects I've worked on. Basically, as a screenwriter, you know, your job is to create the raw materials to allow the cast and crew to do a great job on site. You know, you need to give them enough that they can make compelling drama and capture it on film. That's the sort of point. You know, with prose fiction, you're responsible for creating the whole world. The burden of the entire world is on the language. And so it really is worth obsessing about the language and getting it just right. You know, I have this kind of sort of quite musical, I like to think of the kind of prose writing in a way, kind of like music, which we can get back to. But with screenwriting, it's not about that. It's really about trying to put yourself, okay, I'm here. What is the location going to be? Okay, how are we going to move this camera? How are we going to cover this scene? Who's going to say what? Does that make sense given, you know, what the audience already knows? It's really an entirely different project. And then once it's all been filmed, of course, the people who's on site, real job is to think about the editor, which is another kind of insight that I really I wish I'd known more about, you know, kind of during our first experience. You've really got to think of, you know, as they say, a film is made three times, and you've really got to have that idea of it's going to be written, it's going to be filmed, and it's going to be edited, and that what it is going to change, and the best way to keep it as consistent and as kind of close to the mark as possible is to think about all three processes at all, you know, throughout the whole creative process. It's very interesting. I must say, I love screenwriting. I wish I look forward to hopefully more opportunities to be involved in filmmaking. There's kind of nothing more exciting than being on a film set and something goes well. You know, you get a good scene in the can. It's just an amazing feeling. You know, they call it lightning in a bottle or whatever, but it really does feel like that. Yeah.
And how do those opportunities come?
So far, very independently. So I work with a director. I think he's one of the most underrated, you know, artistic types in South Africa. His name's Jaco Minnaar. He lives in Cape Town. We used to live around the corner from each other in Woodstock. And so we kind of, yeah, we did a few short films that we kind of just independently kind of wrote, shot, funded ourselves. And then built a bit of a portfolio, I suppose, and then managed to get some funding to do a feature. We then worked with some production partners as the sort of money started to come in and things started to kind of get off the ground. But yes, now we are very much. That's the problem about doing things independently. It's like we're at the bottom of the mountain again, you know, which I'm happy to climb, but it's it's a long way to go.
David, there are 9 years between publication of your first novel and publication of your second novel. I suspect that the gap in terms of when you actually wrote them looks a little bit different. Did you write anything in between, or was Hell of a Country your sophomore project? And did you have any of that sophomore syndrome, doubts about what you were doing, especially since the first book was critically acclaimed, nominated for awards, did well?
Yes, so it was the second project, very, very much. I looked around for a project for a while after the first novel came out, and then I kind of locked into the story and started working on it quite soon afterwards. The film happened between, and that was, for a good couple of years, it took a lot of, I also sort of acted as producer. So it took a lot of writing, rewriting and production, sort of headspace, to get the film done. So that was a bit of a delay. I wasn't sort of as, in my routine as possible. I also, I think it was maybe it was sophomore pressure. I didn't think of it that way, but I felt a lot of pressure to, if you're going to take on a real story, as I, you know, sort of a true crime, as I did in Hell of a Country, really, as we were speaking about earlier, to do it properly and to that, just the process was much more involved. There was a lot more research, and a lot more, sort of struggling to find the right voice for the novel, a voice that could include other, you know, multiple voices, a kind of, polyphonic sort of voice for the book. Took a while, you know, it was a kind of I needed to get better at writing to be able to write it, if that makes sense. Having said all that, I did finish the book quite a few years before it was published, so the delay looks a little bit longer than it kind of might have been, but that's fine.
And that decision to write about a true crime, because the way you're speaking now, it sounds like you almost, that was the first part of the idea, I'd like to do a true crime, or was it that story that attracted you? Talk us through that.
I didn't write this story because I wanted to write a crime novel. I wrote a crime novel because I wanted to write about this story. Is very much the kind of the way around I would put it. I was, you know, Fiona, we were talking earlier about the response to Like It Matters. You know, one of the responses was that it didn't actually kind of take on South Africa to a certain extent. You know, it was kind of a very personal story of addiction that happened in these kind of like margins of Cape Town. It was like kind of Salt River and Musenberg, these kind of like, you know, slightly kind of edgy, sort of somewhat liminal urban spaces. And so I thought to myself, well, okay, what would it mean for me to kind of like really explicitly write a book about South Africa in one way or another? And it's kind of a bit of a funny story how the story actually kind of came to me, which we can get into. But once I had discovered, because I'd never heard of The Scissors Murder, but once I discovered the story, it just seemed to pack into it, kind of embody just a lot of the things I wanted to explore, understand about this place. You know, where we came from, where our society maybe kind of comes from. It just became kind of quite clear to me that this was the story that I felt like I needed to write. And then, the doubt more came into like, can I do this? What's the, you know, what does a true crime novel written by me even kind of look like, you know? I wouldn't say it was like a sophomore novel necessarily, although that was probably working away on a subconscious, unconscious kind of basis. But, it was more just fears about like, am I going to do this story justice? Because I mean, I couldn't believe no one else had taken it on as a fictional project, to be honest. For me, it's like a really, I don't want to say attractive story. I mean, that makes it sound very kind of callous and sort of thing. But it's, for a novelist, there's a lot to work with. Let me say that.
So please tell us the funny story about what came to you. And also just for the listener who doesn't have a clue what your book is about, in telling us, give a little bit of a clue what the story is.
Yes, thank you. Hell of a Country is based on a true crime from the early 70s in South Africa, known popularly as the Scissors Murder, in which a young sort of white girl enlists a colored amputee to take care of her lover's wife. So it's a kind of it's a tale of murderous adultery. And so that's the sort of basic setup of the novel. Now, the way it came to me was my partner Daniela is a performer, and she wanted to do a performance where she cut her hair live on stage. Exactly. We were pretty cool in our 20s. I've got to admit, in our late 20s at least. She was like, so what can you write for me? How are we going to do this? And I gave it some thought, and I was like, well, okay, so cutting your hair, you might need to change your appearance, you might be running away. Why don't you look for some kind of famous murder stories where someone needs to kind of get away in a hurry? And so she went back through the archive and she found The Scissors Murder. And of course, that's also scissors. So like, you know, it worked perfectly for the little kind of monologue that we devised for her. But, you know, like I said, once she had slid the story over, to my desk, as it were, I was just completely obsessed. You know, it was just exactly, the kind of project I wanted to dive into. Sort of over the length of a novel. You know, for me, I just know novel means 2-3 years at least. So it has to be a project that's going to keep me interested for that kind of, you know, period of time.
Why do you think that story had such an impact at the time? Why was it the Huisgenoot U magazine story of its day? What were the elements?
Oh, no, that is a fantastic question, because I think there are two ways to answer this. So At its time, I think it was just such a scandalizing story. You know, it was this kind of story of collusion between, like, you know, these two people who shouldn't even be interacting with each other. You know, how did that even happen? And then she was such a, sexualized, sexual sort of being, in such a conservative kind of, prim and proper, context, that I think that it was just so salacious. It was just, people couldn't wrap their heads around how salacious it was. And it was at the time, I think, treated as this kind of almost circus, kind of like a kind of aberration of what was right and good and proper and should be expected in society. But I think maybe from a more modern perspective, and maybe the argument, one of the things that the book wants to maybe say is that, actually the sort of political forces and the sort of, kind of social, the ideology and the brainwashing of the time actually were the perfect conditions to actually create this crime, rather than this being something that's completely alien. It's actually really much sort of emerges from the system and the kind of terribly unequal power dynamics and the repression that is felt, both by so in my book I call the real life Martinez Cuckoo Alfie, and then I call the real life Marlene Lindbergh Lorraine. Yes, I'll probably use those names going forward just so I keep them straight in my head. Yeah.
I have to ask a question that's a bit off topic. Mm-hmm. How short did she cut her hair?
It was pretty intense. It was pretty short. And she then followed it up. She had long hair. She had like hair down to her hips, I would say. And then she had to follow it up with a shave. So she hacked her hair good and proper.
And you watched this?
Yeah, I was on stage playing banjo at the time.
You can only do that trick once.
It was two nights. Even funnier, it was two nights. So the first night she had to be very she just had to grab locks. But then the second night it was exactly. She really went for it.
You referred earlier to the music, and you said we'll come back to that. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in. You're a person with an array of creativity. There's music and there's writing, and how they feed into each other and how they don't feed into each other. And explain it to me very carefully, because I'm not a musical person, so this is a foreign world for me.
I think I've always just been sort of naturally into writing that. Some books feel like a kind of performance. The prose is just so clearly carefully constructed that there is just this natural musicality to the writing. I've always loved writing like that, and it is the writing that I try and reproduce myself. And then I do think there's maybe something about having a musical ear. I'm sort of self-taught. I've taught myself to play a kind of a variety of instruments. I'm just through listening and recreating. So there might be something there. I really do. It astounds me. Two things astound me. Like, some writers who write with music playing don't get that personally. I mean, for me, like, the writing's meant to be the music. That I don't understand how those two things go. For my day job, I'll put on music and stuff like that. But for writing fiction, I've never got that. And then the other thing I would say is that. I think what's great about music is that often it's kind of composed in sort of themes, So I've also tried to bring something like that, especially if I'm stuck and the writing's not really flowing. I'm more than happy these days to kind of put a few lines that I know are right, the voice is right, the correct on the page, and then almost try connect them. So, if I know that the scene has to be the characters are outside, they go to the threshold, they go inside, I might, just have a great, or what I consider a good line for the outside, for the threshold, and for the interior, and sort of place those down, and then sort of find language to kind of connect those is I find kind of a compositional trick that I'm trying out, especially when I'm not in full flow, and that feels to me a lot like kind of creating some kind of musical part sometimes, where it's like I play with my partner. She also plays guitar, and so we I will often well, shame, she has to repeat certain things again and again, but I will often kind of put things together by, again, sort of finding a part for this, a part for that, and a part for that, and then sort of connecting them together. So I think there is, I think the two do feed into each other. I always find that if I feel like I'm writing well, I'm also, I tend to be getting a lot of joy out of playing guitar. I also tend to be full of ideas for films, and the exact opposite, where if the one is stuck, they all seem to be completely hopeless and like I'd never done them before in my life, if that makes sense. Yeah.
And then weird. If you start doing one, does it trigger all of them? If you force yourself, like, let me force myself to play some more music, does it trigger a domino effect?
It can, which is fantastic. I feel so grateful to have these sort of different ways of getting getting the wheels rolling. It's like, yeah, I also often talk about it like getting a saw into the groove. It's so difficult, you know, when you just sort of, but once you've got a little groove, you can then make progress. So yes, absolutely. Sometimes these different, these different sources of inspiration really do help, push me back to the committed place, you know, for the longer projects. Yeah.
This is interesting to me because I've got a post-it above my desk saying creativity begets creativity to remind myself that, like, if you're stuck, do a little drawing or something and then you'll unstick the writing.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about biofiction, which is the connection between things that happened in so-called real life and a sort of fictional reimagining of them. You've changed the names of the characters. This is only based on the Scissors murder. Why did you want to hook it in reality at all rather than just create your own fictional story? What did that hook give you?
Excellent question. For me, it's almost like it was an impossible to deny the reality. You know, the what I kept from the sort of basic mechanics of this true crime, it's just so, it felt like the kind of crime, I guess what attracted me to the story, that could have only happened in this place at this time with these kind of dynamics. So it felt wrong to just completely pretend like, you know, no, this is just, you know, completely made up. I did want to link it to, this actually happened. I guess also maybe just to reinforce that point, that this is really the history out of which, you know, our current society has emerged. But at the same time, as you said, I did change quite a lot. And most of it, again, I think first and foremost to create a better read. I think we can kind of get into it, but I think most of it is kind of around timing, timelines, sort of keeping the story taut. But then once you start making one change, it obviously has the snowball effect where certain character details then changed, and then once, In a fictional sense, characters start to assume these roles for the book, then you kind of steer into that, don't you? And you kind of make the certain roles more clearly defined than maybe they were in real life, for example. But that's, I kind of deferred always to the kind of logic or the kind of rules of fiction rather than real life, proceeding from that real sort of situation.
You made what was for me a very interesting choice at the moment when the murder takes place. You changed a detail of what happens in the house when the murder occurs. So obviously we can never really know what happened, but there's a situation on record of what a character said happened, and you made a significant change there. What were you doing there? I don't want to spoil anything, but were you sort of trying to fit the imperatives of character there, or why did you make that change?
Yes, I think without spoiling, it was for me the right way for these character arcs to fulfill themselves. I think that the way that the two characters were drawn in the book are, I think, there are times where they hew maybe very closely to sort of the real life counterpart, and then other places where they kind of diverge a bit. And I think given those choices along the way, it became clear to me that in this, you know, climactic section, that the characters, these characters, you know, these sort of fictional people that that I created needed to experience what they end up experiencing in the book, maybe rather than what really happened. Although, as you said, you know, that is very contested. And I mean, in a society where, you know, the real life Martinez Kuku was tried as an other, you know, not even by his name, I feel like the facts such as they are should be contested. And I think maybe it's even just kind of quite an interesting imaginative exercise to think of things in a different way. Let me just say that. Yeah.
And did you have enough fun with this true crime writing that you would do it again? Are you doing it again?
No, it's a great question. And I mean I do think that you know, crime, especially historical sort of crime, is an interesting field in South Africa, because there are just these stories where there is a record of, yeah, things, you know, the cracks showing is the way I see it. You know, there are many such examples. Whether I'll do it again, certainly not the next project. You know, I tend to, yes, I never thought I would take on such a research intensive project. You know, it sort of surprised even me. I did. I really did enjoy it. I actually think it was important for me to really, you know, one, thinks they understand a lot about you know, how things were back in the day, but to really dive into the both primary and kind of secondary sources, you know, just it's very humbling to reflect on, you know, just quite how different things were, you know, even if we wish maybe they were even more different than things are now. You know, we wish things had maybe changed even more, but it is still incredible to think of how far we've come. You know, the Scissors murder was 50 years ago. That's not a long time in the grand scheme of things. So I find, I think it was a very interesting project, very important for me to do. I look forward to something a little bit more imaginative and sort of, yeah, I think I'm hoping the next one will be more trying to do something interesting in terms of form than I have done so far. You know, both books are, so far have been quite straight. I mean, linear sort of novels. I'm wondering about maybe trying something a little bit different next time.
Yeah, 50 years ago. So the events of this novel took place before you were even born. And in the book, you show people living with grand apartheid, with the signs of, you know, whites only and white only entrances and all this kind of thing. You've touched on the research that you did for this book, but could you take us a bit deeper on that? How exactly did you research life in the 70s?
Yeah, so a variety of sources. And so I found kind of almost two categories. So the first category was finding out about the crime. And that was looking at sort of the, you know, official court records. That was looking at newspapers from the time, sort of microfiche and then the rest of it. And as many, what's wonderful about Joburg is that there are so many eccentric, weird bookstores where you can walk in and pick something off the shelf that was published in 1971 and it's just bizarre. Like, I mean, just these weird, it's like, who put money up to publish this? But anyway, yeah, so it was very interesting just to kind of just really pick up things from the era and go like, whoa, okay, that's, yeah, things were different. So there was that, but there was that side of it. But then, you know, what I found interesting was even more useful for me was the sort of artistic responses of the time. So it was reading fiction, you know, kind of like Alex Laguma, writing a little bit before the 70s, but, you know, that kind of mid-60s period, Richard Reeve, and then lots of photography, specifically kind of Billy Monk. There's a section in the book that is basically like a kind of rewriting of, you know, Billy Monk kind of photographs. And other photographs of the time were really helpful. Honestly, I should probably kind of like share it as like a public good, but I have a folder on my computer with like thousands of images from the 70s in South Africa. I just kind of studiously, diligently collected them wherever I could. And then a lot of scenes we're really just kind of staring at a photo, imagining it, sort of animating and kind of going from there, you know, to try and preserve the textures and the, and this, you know, of the period as much as possible. Yeah, daunting. I mean, I've always also just loved the 70s as a thing. I always wanted to create something, whether it was a film or a book set in the 70s. So I'm so glad I've been able to do that. And I would also say, yeah, you know, 70s films, obviously not a lot of, South African examples, but the way the book is structured, you know, the kind of cross-cutting from Lorraine to Elfie mostly, I hope kind of reminds people of a kind of, you know, one of those sort of 70s films, the way it sort of all comes together. I'm hoping it's a bit of a cinematic kind of reading experience.
Before we started recording, you talked a little bit about a frustrating situation with international agents, mm-hmm. and you've also had experience publishing short stories in American magazines. You know, you have reached out for that international audience. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience, how you went about it, and whether you regret it, whether it worked for you?
Yeah, great question. You know, one gets told that not your only hope, but I mean, it is one is advised strongly to try and find kind of, you know, overseas representation and to get your books into overseas markets. I haven't quite been successful in terms of the novels yet, but I certainly don't regret the chance. Basically, what happened was it actually started with the first book, Like It Matters. There was someone who was interested in the UK, and we kind of worked together for a while on some edits, and then those didn't kind of go so well, and the related, I was sort of maybe passed on to another agent in the UK, and their decision was, let's not kind of push for this first book, but the next one. And so then when the next one was duly done, I submitted it. And look, I really don't have any ill feelings. It was just a time when their career had sort of just recently taken off. A couple of the books or the writers they represented had just been nominated for some very big prizes, etc. So I feel like my manuscript fell a little bit in between the cracks. And then, yeah, it was just a matter of not being able to sort of, you know, kind of wait any longer before I sort of then took the next phase of shopping it around into my own hands. So I haven't had a very fulfilling kind of overseas agent relationship yet, but it came to me by chance, and it left equally by chance. So I regrets, and I do still have that ambition. It is interesting. I've been asked a couple of times kind of talking about the book whether I think maybe it's too South African for an overseas audience. Like, you know, are the South Africanisms in the sort of dialogue and the writing, is the subject matter the kind of thing that you need to kind of live here to really kind of resonate with? I mean, I don't know, you know, it's an interesting question. It's not something that I think will necessarily determine how I write the next book, though. I feel like often it's the things that are actually most local that end up being, you know, internationally kind of loved. It's just like, you know, so much of this is kind of luck and timing. And do you have the right book for the right moment? I try not to think about that stuff too much, because it's, you can get paralysis, I think.
Absolutely.
And can you tell us a little bit about what readers can look forward to next? Mm. What is this manuscript that you've just got feedback on that you're a little bit disappointed in?
So that was the feedback related to publishing something else that is older, the stories basically. One day I hope still will see the light of day, but maybe just, you know, one needs a bit more of a name as a novelist. I totally understand that. I mean, there's really no point in doing something that's I don't want to say doomed to failure, but one should set these things up for success as much as possible. So yeah, the next thing, do you know, like I said, it's formally I'm trying to do something maybe interesting with the form, and it's one of those ones where I actually don't know if it's going to work until I'm finished it, and so I'm kind of a bit terrified to say too much, because it might be one of those things that it's better that nobody knows much about in the end. But I'm hoping to get a draft done with the rest of this year. I'm sure that is an achievable target for me. And then, we'll see how it goes. I'm hoping definitely not for another wait of 9 years before the next book. That's also my goal.
David, we always like to ask our guests what they have been reading or watching or listening to lately that's made an impression.
So reading, I'd actually love to know from you guys what your sort of diet is like, but I reread kind of as much as I read new things. Sometimes I think I should really prioritize kind of going, sort of seeking more things out, but I tend to reread, writers that I know I like a lot, and I've been doing that, quite a bit recently. So I've been reading some Eudora Welty. I love her stories so much. Claire Keegan, I finally finished, is it called Walk in the Blue Fields, I think, is the one story collection that I hadn't read, so now I'm a Claire Keegan completist. I had to read Michael Hines's new novel. I have the great privilege of interviewing him at the Garden Route Festival coming up, so that was also fantastic. Quite varied reading. I really enjoyed I don't know if you've seen Bugonia, the new Yorgos Lanthimos film. I thought that was a return to form. I really loved his earlier stuff like Dogtooth and The Lobster and Killing of a Sacred Deer. And I thought this Bugonia was really brilliant. I loved that. Listening, I am trying to teach myself a bit of bluegrass guitar. And so I've been listening to a lot of bluegrass music recently, which is really incredible. I find it very great working music. There you go. There's I wouldn't put it on while I'm writing fiction, but while I'm doing my day job, bluegrass is doing it for me at the moment.
Well, we hope that everyone checks out Hell of a Country. It's out now by Quella Books. It's available everywhere. And if people can find Like It Matters, is it available electronically anywhere?
It might be. It's difficult to know. if you have a copy, please do cherish it, because it's very difficult to find this book. Do have a look.
Well, I found Hell of a Country a remarkable work. I loved the way you supplied backstories for your characters, and the way you conjured up that 1970s era of grand apartheid, petty apartheid, and just living with that as your daily reality. It's masterful, and I can see why it's been so well received by the critics. But thank you so much for your time. This has been absolutely fascinating.
Thank you. I've had such a great time. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, David.
Gail, I love it when we have young writers come on our podcast who are at the beginning of their careers and have such an energy about them. I find it energizes me.
Absolutely. I feel very energized from that conversation. Although the way David was complaining about his body, I don't know if he would define himself as a young writer. but absolutely, he's got that energy. He's got that buzzing creativity that is almost infectious.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And what did you take particularly from that?
I was so interested in how he kept bringing it back to character. A lot of the questions that we asked, his answer was that the character drove the process, that it needed to turn out that way because that was what was true for the character. And that was both in his completely fictional novel, Like It Matters, and his biofiction, Hell of a Country, where the characters are based on real life people. But it always came down to character for him. And I think that is quite a good way of doing it. If you're wondering to yourself, you know, what should happen now? Should it go in this direction or shouldn't it? If you ask yourself, what would this character do? What is right for this character? I think you're going to end up going in a good direction.
I agree with you, and I think it's an area that I struggle with a bit. I think I become so focused on plot and story that I lose character a bit, and it's something I need to be working on.
Me too. It was a good reminder for me personally. And what were good reminders for you?
So there was a lot of things. I was interested in what he said, the way he sees language like music. He said the writing is meant to be the music, and that sounded, but we know I'm not musical, so the writing won't be the music for me. I was interested in his, the way the creativity sparks the creativity and that, that whole creative life thing. But the thing I want to talk about is he quoted Raymond Carver and said that anyone should be able to give advice. Everyone's advice is valid. Every piece of feedback you get on your writing is a valid point of view.
So interesting.
So interesting. Because there is that terrible temptation that if you don't agree with the feedback, to go, this is not important feedback. Mm. That's the one aspect. Although I do think you must be able to some extent to say, this isn't resonating with me. I'm not, you can't follow everybody's advice.
Yes.
You'll never finish writing. So you do have to know how to choose the right, that the advice that resonates with you. But the other thing I am bad at that this made me think about is I don't use beta readers.
Right.
Because I've kind of made the decision, all that advice gets confusing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just stick to my own advice and then to my editor's advice when we get to editing phase. And I don't use beta readers because of that. And I do wonder if I miss out on a very important layer of writing. You use beta readers, don't you?
I have. I think twice used sort of external beta readers. And I have two tame beta readers in the house.
Yes.
Who are excellent. Their input is so, so good, and I've become so dependent on it. I can't make a move. I can't do anything without referring to them. But yes, it's almost, I'm reluctant to go there because I don't feel like a whole rewrite at this stage.
Yes.
I just want to push ahead and get this through and, you know, get the official feedback. But I've never regretted it when I have done it.
Interesting. Interesting. I think this is also, I was also thinking about while he spoke. We've spoken to a few writers who do this very slow thing, who are satisfied if they, he said, if I remove a few words, well, that's a good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you and I would cry into our pillows if we remove 3 words in our writing morning. And that difference between, we're quite compelled by that forward movement.
Yes.
Which is good and bad. And yes, it's interesting. I suppose what it comes down to is that reminder, everyone does it differently and nothing's wrong.
Yes, absolutely. So if anyone has read Like It Matters or Hell of a Country by David Cornwell, if you have any thoughts about what we've been talking about today, please get in touch. We're on all social media across the board, and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.